We are on this affair between Amulek and Almon. It's a very important one. If I can get things straight here. In the second chapter of Alma. Now, who's fighting who here? Things had been going very bad with the church because of Nehor. Nehor had taken all the people away, and they all thought they were the true church. Nehor did too, and Alma did too. And a man by the name of Amalekai, I thought he could cash in on the Nehor movement. He wanted to go all the way, become extreme right-wing, and make himself king. So we have two factions facing each other. And here you don't have Nephites versus Lamanites at all. Because they're both Nephites on both sides. And Amulekites and everything mixed up. And soon, already, Amalekai has planned to join up with the Lamanites. As far as Nephi is concerned, it's not the good people and the bad people. It's not the church against the opponents of the church. They're both following Alma here. Most of them didn't want to go as far right as Amalekai meant. So some of the church, all the church, and most of the other people stuck with Alma. So we have a very mixed thing. This is a typical Latin America, Central America mix-up of things. Some guy wants to make himself power, and he's a general, and he wants to be the whole thing, you see. And so we're on familiar grounds here. All these wars take place on that scale amid great confusion. Who's on which side? Some people are going to start running away. Some people are going to start changing sides. And so it's not Nephites versus Lamanites. And it's not believers versus pagans. They're believers on both sides. You see, Amalekai got a lot of Nehor's people. He was Nehor himself. And they said, we're the true church. On the other hand, Alma, most of the people that followed Alma didn't belong to his church, didn't want his church, and so it goes this way. Typical affair. And it certainly wasn't the good guys versus the bad guys, as we'll find out. You think it would be at least that, but no, it isn't. And so we have here, don't try to follow, put a situation map on the board. It would be useless here. It's quite a complicated affair militarily, and a very interesting one too. Amalekai is a very shrewd strategician. He knows how to do it. He sets up on a hill, of course. Well, it seems to be a fortified hill. It's referred to at other times. And it's on the shore, apparently, of the river, which makes it impossible to surround him. That would give him one advantage, at least. It's on the hill which is east of the riverside, and the river, which is the river which bounds the land, as a matter of fact. And here we go. He's on the river to avoid probably being surrounded here. Where's what we have a note here? Yes. He's trying to total takeover of power. And the east and west is very confusing. The war is fought on both sides of the river. We don't need to worry about these particulars, but it's an interesting one if you try to analyze what they're doing here. War is fought on the east side of the river Sidon. They began to make war with the Nephites. They took that as their post. That's where they raised their banner, and they invited combat there, you see. Remember, ancient war was formalized and ritualized, and notice, there they began to make war with the Nephites. They chose the time and the place of the war, and it was on a hill, a strong point, on the river, and this was the river that didn't divide the land, it says, but which ran by the land of Zarahemla. It's more like a boundary, you see. It ran by the land. How near they're committed to that, or at a small distance. Well, then Alma went up with his people, with his captains at the head of his army. Notice his threefold function. He's chief judge. Again, he is head of the army now, and he's chief of the church. He's everything. He could easily become a dictator, you see, and that, which is exactly what Amalekai wanted to do. He wanted to make himself king. And they began to slay Amalekites on the hill east of Sidon. So the hill is on the east side of the river. And they attacked the base there. And the Amalekites began to flee. And the Nephites pursued them that day and slew them with much slaughter. So these are royalist Nehors versus a mixed group of Nephites here. And the political conflict is nastier than that, than the war with their brethren, the Lamanites. Notice the Nephite wars are always the dirtiest. They don't have much trouble with the Lamanites, actually. Well, they mix them up. Well, it came to pass that Alma, the 20th verse in the second chapter, He could pursue the Amalekites no longer. He caused that he should pitch his tent in the Valley of Gideon. Well, we could put a Valley of Gideon there. That was going to be their base camp. And here's a reminder of the original trouble. It all goes back to Gideon, who slew the same Nehor by the sword. So these things are all related. They go back to Nehor country again, where Gideon camp, the camp of Gideon against Nehor. Now it was their camp against Amalekai. These places apparently have strategic value. And he sent spies to know the plots of the others. And the plot was a clever one. He'd had an agreement with the Lamanites to get their support. You can see that. And a chance for the Lamanites to get some support, chance for the Nephites too, to Amalekai too, to win the battle. And so they watched the camp of the Amalekites, so the Amalekites watched their camp. In the foul womb of night, as Shakespeare says, the two camps watching each other. And the camps were very close together, too. On the morrow, they returned to the camp. They were greatly astonished to find that the Amalekites had made contact with the Lamanites. A complete surprise. Above the land of Zarahemla, they've gone above the land again. Where is that? Apparently to the north, land of Zarahemla, because when they fall back, it's always going to be toward the north then. That's where their supplies are coming from. That's where their strength is, the north and the west. And behold, the Amalekites have joined them. So this was a planned operation, as we read in 215 here, upon the hill east by the river Sidon and so forth. He took up that position with a contact with the Lamanites in mind all the time, perhaps to fall back on it, drawing the Nephites away from Zarahemla. It's a very, very shrewd action, you see. That's why the hill Amnihu was not in the central position, you see. We're told in the 27th verse it was the hill on the Lamanite side of the river. So it was a good thing, but there were Nephites living on both sides. And so it goes on here. And then they discovered not only that the Amalekites had joined up with the Nephites, but the people settled. You see, these were just armies fighting here now. And you may have heard the lecture on the French Revolution the other day, how from the French Revolution, the first time you find the people in arms, the people just stood by and watched wars being fought before, you see. And moreover, they didn't have uniforms before. They didn't have the type of militarism before at all. The Nephites were still living in the land and cultivating it there. Now they started to run away. Some very funny things happened there. I remember going out with a person called Smith. He was a professional prize fighter, and he was General Max Taylor's aide. Max Taylor wanted something fresh, some salad, and Smith had spotted a place where there was some lettuce growing near a farmhouse. It was all deserted, so we went out to get the lettuce by the farmhouse. It was on the German side of the line, and the other was up toward Arnhem, and we crossed this canal, and there we have it. There was the lettuce, sure enough. But as soon as we started to get the lettuce, then they started dropping not bazookas, boy, far gone today. No, they started shooting, not with shells, but with, what do you do when you shoot short up, close up? Well, anyway, they started lobbing these grenades in, and we'd hide behind the house, and then, incidentally, how wild things got all of a sudden. The house was completely overgrown, inside and outside, though the people had only been away for a couple of weeks. It's a wet country, you know, with vines all inside, and there were sheep running around. The sheep were wild. They were fierce, amazing. We could have got some good mutton there. But they started shooting mortar shots, small sight mortar. There was an embankment and a canal, an embankment and a canal over here. And on this green canal, there were a dozen little Dutch boys playing soldier. And all this bang-banging was going on, and these boys continued to play soldiers and paid no attention to us whatever. They were having their game. They weren't interested in our game in the least, you see. See, the civilians go their own way. They don't get involved in these things until we involve them in war now and deliberately do all the sorts of things we do. But it was so interesting to see those little kids. They weren't interested in what we were doing. They had the real thing over there. The imagination is more important. And that happens. Quite a number of occasions like that. Some little Polish kids having a picnic. Some little Polish kids having a picnic, and all this shooting was going on around them. They were right in between, but these were the nicest trees, they said, so they'd have their picnic here. All these little Polish kids, they just marched like Boy Scouts. Marvelous kids. They had such spirit, and they were led by a little girl that were very neatly dressed and so forth, very proper. They were practically slaves. This was in Nazi Germany, you know, they're fussy. And here they were walking out, marching out to have their picnic. And she was telling them, watch in step, be proud, don't make them ashamed of you. These strange things. Well, it's the same way here. The people began to run toward the city. Another race toward the city, and the people of Nephi departed out of Gibeon, which was their camp. They left there, and they made a race for Zarahemla too. That's where the army was. So both the army and the civilians, everybody's making toward Zarahemla to get there before Amalekai gets it. And they had to cross the river Sidon to get there. And this was the border. It was on the border, we're told, and this was the trap. And it was there, the sands of the sea, they came upon them to destroy them. They were waiting for them at the forge. These rivers could forge. It's very clear that the Sidon could be forged here. And they came upon them to destroy them. And Alma fought with Amalekai on the sword face to face. Now here you have a good case of Star Wars, the good guy versus the bad guy. Always, only such seed. We could destroy the wicked. And we see this, reflecting on this one, if we go to 4, 2, and 3 here, after this war, if you think these people were the good guys, it said and the people were afflicted, yea, greatly afflicted for the loss of their brethren, and also for the loss of their flocks and their herds, and for the loss of their fields of grain, and which were trodden underfoot and destroyed by the Lamanites, did them no good. And so great were their afflictions that every soul had cause to mourn, and they believed that it was the judgment of God sent upon them because of their wickedness. Therefore they were awakened to remembrance of their duty, and that was the promise given to Nephi, that the Lord would always have the Lamanites breathing down their neck to stir them up to remembrance. And this is another case where it happened. When they were wicked, that's what brought on the war. As Mormon tells us later on, behold, don't worry about the wicked, he says. Behold, the judgment of God will surely overtake the wicked, and it's by the wicked that the wicked are punished. They're going to be punished, but make sure it isn't by you, that you're not doing the punishing. Well, then he slew Amalekai with a sword, and he also contended the king of the Lamanites and his guards. And then there's more business. No, notice here, they cleared the ground. They have to get over to the west bank for the big fighting, though. They had to clear the ground on the west bank, and they might have room to cross and contend with the Lamanites and Amalekites on the west side. So a strong force is waiting for them on the west side of the river. When they'd all crossed the river, the Lamanites and the Amalekites began to flee before them. So they didn't have the engagement after all, when they'd all got across. And they fled before them, and they fled north and west beyond the borders. Right way up there. And in fact, it went so far, it went to Hermounts. Now, this word Hermounts is really an interesting one. 37. They were slain and driven and were scattered on the west and the north until they reached the wilderness, which is called Hermounts, and it was part of the wilderness which was infested by wild and ravenous beasts. Now, where does the word Hermounts come from? I'm going to have to write this one on the board. We can take off our hat now. I think there are ladies present. Hermounts. Now, this is certainly not a Latin word. It's not a Greek word. It's not a Hebrew word. It's not a Semitic word. Hermounts. And where was it? It was a land on the borders that was infested at times by wild beasts at certain seasons of the year. So it's way up in the borders. They're going way up there, you see. So what it is the Egyptian Hermonthis, obviously. Monthis. In Egypt, Month was the Egyptian Pan. He was the god of wild places. He was the god of wild animals in the wild country, Monthis. And Hermonthis was the southernmost part of Egypt, where the land was sometimes visited by lions and crocodiles and things like that. It was under cultivation, but it was the place that was in danger from animals, and they called it Hermonthis because it was Month's country, wild animal country, you see. They say Month is the Egyptian Pan. So we have this Her means under the rule of Month. Month is the beneficent lord of wild animals, the animals. And Hermonthis was that ground in Egypt, which was the part far removed and yet was visited by animals. And they call this part Hermounts. No other word could match it so perfectly because it was infested at times by wild beasts. Now, if there was a coincidence, and that is the most unimagine the most fantastic word in the Book of Mormon because it has no philological connections, you see, until you recognize Hermonthis. And so we go on. Then finally, there we have a shattered host then. They really are shattered, and they begin to run. And this is an interesting thing, you see. Amalekai's people could go home, and they did. But it was only on agreement on convenience with the Lamanites, who didn't want them there. I mean, they could not go home, and they did not. Amalekai said, where were they to go? Everybody fled toward the north, toward the far west, as far as they could get, way up there to Hermontas, it says, and amongst the beasts. But the poor Amalekites are dead now. Naturally, you'd think the Lamanites would welcome their in. They had had this agreement with them, not a bit of it. The Lamanites say, we don't know you, owe you a thing. Many died in the wilderness of their wounds and were devoured by those beasts and also the vultures of the air. Their bones have been found and have been heaped upon the earth. They could not go home, you see, now. It was only an agreement of convenience with the Lamanites. The Lamanites didn't feel any responsibility for them. They just let them hanging in the wind. The Amalekites had nowhere to go, went up the northward and were not able to survive there. And so they were destroyed. And now we come to we've been speaking a lot of ethnology here, and now we come to perhaps the most important ethnic chapter in the book. I must get this book of, what's his name for this, a person by the name of Fillmore S.C. Northrop has written a book, a recent one on East and West, an anthropology book here, which I'm going to read in a minute. Now here we are. They returned to their lands and returned to their houses and their wives and their children, all back to where we started. And it was a sad affair. Many women and children had been slain with the sword, many of their flocks and herds, and also many of their fields of grain. This is the perennial tragedy of Latin America, isn't it? It's these sad pictures. And the greatness of their number, and not the number of the slain were not numbered because of the greatness of their number. After they'd finished burning, they all returned to their lands and to their houses and their wives and their children. And then it says, nothing was gained by this political brawl. That's what it was, you see. Flocks and herds had been lost, and also many of their fields and grain were destroyed, for they were trodden down by the hosts of men. They were in the depths of the sea. Now this is interesting too, notice, and cast into the waters of Sidon, and behold, their bones are in the depths of the sea. That was near the mouth of the river Sidon. It would be very unsanitary just to throw their bodies in the river, but it said they were swept out to sea. So there, it'd be quite close. Remember, it's a narrow neck of land here. It puts us into some sort of scale anyway, that they were swept out to sea. It shows that the river Sidon was not only fordable, but it emptied into the ocean not far away. And this third verse. And the Amalekites, now they'd marked themselves. Now here we get the ethnic mark. What makes a race here? Well, they decide to be Lamanites. They identify with Lamanites, and this happens again and again. And they marked themselves with red in their foreheads after the manner of the Lamanites. And nevertheless, they had not shown their heads like the Lamanites. So they're being different degrees now. They look like Lamanites because of that mark. Now the heads of the Lamanites were shorn, and they were naked, save it were the skin which was girdled about their loins. Well, now people that went around like that all the time would certainly have darker skins than people that didn't. It's the same thing, you see. This makes the blackness. Notice he's going to tell us in this chapter, the Lamanites put the marks on themselves. They marked themselves not knowing that they were fulfilling the promise of the Lord that he would mark them. A way of life produces this darkening of the skin. Of course, it's the same way all over the world, you see. You have the Bait al-Sha'r and the Bait al-Hadr. The people that live in the stone houses have white complexions, and the people live in the tents, in the houses of hair, of goat's hair, they have dark complexions. That always distinguished among the Arabs, the people in the houses, the same people, the same blood, but there's a great deal of difference between them. They're much, much lighter. And it's the same thing, if you'll notice, in Greek vase paintings. Of course, the women are always painted with white faces because they're in-house all the time. Also use white lead, that would help. And the men are always painted bronze, quite bronze, especially in those marvelous paintings from the island. I was thinking those from a. It's from Crete, but no, I'm thinking from the has two names, Sparta, and the other one is. All the commandments, they're various islands, but they show these things very clearly, the dark and the light, and the Egyptians the same way too. I mean, Egyptians, the very same way, you see, the women are always painted a pale, very pale color, and the men are always a dark brown. It's a matter of being living outdoors and so forth. Well, this would account for one part of their the island of Santorini, of course, the ancient island of Thera, the one that blew up. But there we find these marvelous paintings from 1600 BC. And they're gorgeous paintings, sure. But always the men are dark, the women are white, or you find two different races and people and so forth. And so the same thing here, that they'd mark themselves and went around naked, and so they're going to get that way. And you find your way, if you go down and live with those people, you get that way. You very soon get that desert varnish on your face, and you learn to walk with the drag of your feet because you're walking in the sand. And you don't mind, you don't try to walk straight, because why should you when you're slugging through the sand and so forth? You get to look and feel just like a Hopi there, an Indian. The skins of the Lamanites were dark according to the mark which was set on them by their fathers, which is a curse upon them because of their transgression. Well, who set it on them? The father set on it. It's going to be a way of life of culture. Where do racial characters come from in the first place? They come from environment, don't they? Everybody agrees on that. Adaption, segregation. People in the north want to get all the sun they can, so I have no pigmentation at all. If I lived in the south, I'd have to be protected from the sun, so I'd be dark. This is the way it goes.
It was their fathers who placed the curse upon
them.
Their
way of life, yes.
Due to the way of life that they chose.
Also, the things, yes, they chose it. And they remember, they took to this way of life by their own free will. And it was, notice, and this adaption is very fast. This is the most interesting thing. I guess I better put Herdlicka's name on the board. You all know about Elis Herdlicka. Well, it's taught by certain things, races formed by adaption to certain climatic conditions and so forth, and then it's by separation. When groups separate, they go off in different distances and get different from each other, but in doing so, they also join up with others. So then you get segregation and you get process of joining again, which is exactly what you had at Babel, the so-called Tower of Babel. At Babel, that was a place where people scattered in all directions, and the languages were scattered, and also people came together from all directions, and new languages are formed. Whenever you bring people together, different people together, you get a new language. Whenever you separate one people, you get two languages. The dialects will start up just like that. So here, again, the man who talked about the French Revolution, you said, remember, until the French Revolution, France didn't have, they didn't speak French, they spoke all sorts of things. Dialects. They were dialects. They melted into French, so forth and so on. But as soon as people separate, they get their dialects. They get different languages. Then came the revolution, and they started a regular system of education. And within a generation, they all began speaking the same French. The same things happen in the Book of Mormon. You know that where the people, Mosiah teaches the people Nephite, and it makes them much more efficient in their business and so forth. But bilingual people are very common. I mean, you're hearing much Spanish spoken around here now. When I came here, you never would hear anybody speaking Spanish, let alone an Oriental language. That was absolutely out of the question. Now you hear it all the time. Things do change, and they change rapidly. And Herdlicka is a good example. I write name Herdlicka because the way of spelling it. Elis Herdlicka. He's a Yugoslav, a Croatian. Elis Herdlicka. Now, he came over here and he was an anthropologist and became the most famous anthropologist of his time. He came over from Yugoslavia. He spent millions, an enormous project, trying to prove the Alaska Bridge, that the Indians came over the Bering Strait and so forth, and never was able to prove it because they didn't have the kind of evidence they do today. It's still a different story today. That's nothing's been settled up there. But he was interested in immigration, and he started making checks on immigrants coming. He settled in New York first and then went to Harvard, and he started checking immigrants and the children of immigrants here to see how they differed in bodily build, complexion, and everything from their parents. And he found within the first generation, he went through thousands of cases, became a very celebrated work. I mean, he became the daddy of American anthropology here. And he discovered that in the first generation, no matter which country people came from, well, he specialized mostly in Mediterranean, dark Mediterranean and Eastern people. All their children were noticeably taller, all their children were noticeably blonder, all their children had noticeably larger chest measurements, all their children had notably longer legs and so forth. In one generation, they started changing, notably. The Israelis found that. I mean, there's volumes of, in Israeli, these short, swarthy Eastern European Jews would go to Israel and have tall, blonde children. Everybody was just electrified. How come? We changed so suddenly like that. It's an amazing thing that happened. You find all sorts of articles on that. But these changes by segregation, joined together and so forth, but merely moving over into another environment? How could that work? Well, nobody knows, but statistically it did work on a massive scale, and Herdlicher's work was very convincing and made him very famous. But here we go on. And their brethren sought to destroy them, therefore they were cursed, and the Lord sought to set a mark on them, yea, Laman and Lemuel, and also the son of Ishmael and the Ishmaelitish women. They were also dark, you notice. Was it because they intermarried? Remember, we're told that Laman and Lemuel intermarried with sons and daughters of Ishmael. Well, they all did for that matter. But remember, these Ishmaelites here now, they're Arabs of the desert, but after all, Lehi is of Manasseh. He's just as much a desert as they are, and they all get mixed up here. And this was done, their seed might distinguish from the seed of their brethren, that they thereby God might preserve his people, that they might not mix and believe in incorrect traditions. Notice tradition has the priority here. And here again, things that God does but men may not do here. He may give life, men may not. He may take life, men may not, we're told in Ether 8 and 19. He may judge, men may not judge. God may smite, men may not smite. God says, Mormon says, man shall not smite, neither shall he judge, or shall not judge, neither shall he smite. Well, there are all sorts of things that God does, but he segregates them here, and he segregates them in his own way. He has this way of doing it. But notice the tradition has priority. He doesn't want them to mingle with incorrect tradition, so he puts a slight mark on them to keep them apart, to distinguish them, and yet they're going to be joining together all the time here. Then, this is what happens. Whosoever did mingle his seed, that is, his people, one people with another, with that of the Lamanites, did bring the same curse on him, share the same culture as that. They were not just Nephites. Remember, it came to pass that whosoever mingled his seed with that of the Lamanites, not just Nephites, but anybody who did, because there were more Mulekites than Lamanites there, but anybody who mixed with the Lamanite did bring the same curse upon his seed. And you call the curse the culture. Depends on how you want it. Therefore, if you suffered yourself to be led away by the Lamanites, marriage is not enough, you see. You have to share their culture. It's not a physical thing, by marriage. You have to be led away by them and join in their way of life, their culture. Was called under that head, he was called by that name, therefore, and there was a mark set upon him, and you set it on yourself, actually. Came to pass that whosoever would not believe in the tradition of the Lamanites, notice it's the traditions that we're separating here, not the blood, not the people, tradition of the Lamanites, but believed on those records which were brought out of the land of Jerusalem, they were called Nephites, no matter what your family was or anything else, you were called a Nephite. A Nephite or a Lamanite was one who accepted a tradition, the Nephite or the Lamanite tradition. This 11th verse makes that very clear. And if you have not accepted the scenario, it is they who have kept the records which are true, and also of the people, true of the people of the Lamanites. Now, they start marking themselves here in this verse here, in the 13th verse. It's the Amalekites, they had set a mark upon them, yea, they set a mark upon themselves, a mark of red upon their foreheads. Notice the Amalekites were Nephites who joined the Lamanites, and they set a mark upon their foreheads in imitation of the Lamanites. They wanted to be Lamanites here. Thus, the word of God was fulfilled, for he said, for these are the words of Lamanites, behold, the Lamanites have I cursed, and I will set a mark on them. Well, they were putting the mark on, and this fulfills the prophecy that the Lord said, I will set the mark. When they did it themselves, then they fulfilled the prophecy. Here, this statement by, he's a Yale professor, an anthropologist. I don't have too much trust in Yale anthropologists. I've run into some of them. Or Chicago anthropologists. I shared an office for 4 years with one of them. He was the head of the American Society of Archaeologists, Morris Opler. Oh, we had a lot of times together. He was an Indian man. Let me tell you some stories about him someday. But now, this is what C. Fillmore N.C. Northrop of Yale writes in his book, The Meeting of East and West. With the effects of 18th century impigmentation on cosmological, highly formalized Christian dogma of European-Spanish invasion upon the people of Mexico, at the midpoint of North and South America in Central American continents, to which vast numbers of humans already had come from Asia across the Pacific, and from the Pacific Islands during untold numbers of earlier millenniums. See, there's no reason in the Book of Mormon why there shouldn't be more than one migration. These Pacific Basin people, whom the Spanish invaders found in Mexico, showed a crossbred physiognomy embracing every physical feature and skin color known anywhere around the earth. They're all there. They were so crossbred that they could no longer be spontaneously differentiated into separate color races. This crossbreeding was advanced in both Mexico and India today, but now embraces all European features as well. Every variety of angular pattern of variation in physiognomy found in both countries, in every skin color, every shade from intensely dark to intensely light, hair ranges through every known variety between straight to tight curly, in every hue from black to platinum blonde. About every 10th child among the Hopis was blonde, real blonde. Sometimes redhead, sometimes blonde and blue eyes, and it was not a case. It's not a case of being bleached or anything like that. But and I asked, well, there must have been some missionaries at large here, back in the early days. Oh no, it's always been this way. If you go back to the vase paintings, you'll find the same way. That same percentage of blondness was always there. Here you have these blondes among the Hopis. They're quite surprising in the same house. And you find it among the Greeks, among other people too. But he says, hair color, it ranges to platinum blonde. I say, you do find platinum blonde. And all varieties of hair adorn all varieties of skin color and all varieties of shading from dark to light, in which turn adorn all varieties of facial features and head shapes. Wherefore, few Mexican individuals can be identified as being of any hybrid race. They are simply worldians. Call them that because they've got every race. They're all mixed up together that way. So it is very necessary for them to make a special attempt at marking themselves there. If they hadn't, you couldn't have distinguished them at all. They were all the same dark complexion. No doubt there were plenty of blondes among them, as there are among the Indians, certain Indian tribes and so forth. The blood types are very interesting there. Now, he says, and thus the word of God was fulfilled when he said, behold, the Lamanites I have cursed, and I will set a mark upon them. They were fulfilling the word of God. Their seed may be separated from thy seed from this time henceforth and forever. Now, separated henceforth and forever, a permanent mark forever and forever? No, he puts a limit on it here. Except they repent and return of their wickedness, repent of their wickedness and turn to me that I might have mercy upon them. And it is a reversible process. It's their choice, you see. They control it. Can they even reverse it? Can they do this with race? We can also initiate change in appearance ourselves as far as that goes. Yes.
The skin color, couldn't that have been a symbol of the atonement with the... Because what happens when Jesus comes and visits the Nephites in the praying,
their faces turn
their
white.
Their faces turn white.
But that's light. They're shining. That's a different thing, I think. That's like Moses' face on the mountain and like Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. The shining is another level, yes. Angels belong to a different race. But you get all kinds, I imagine, just the same. This mark we put apart, you see, we're all cooperating in this thing, and it is a cultural thing, and it all goes together, which makes perfectly good sense. And this tells how it was done. When the Nephites joined the Lamanites, they lived like them, they dressed like them, they made look like them. Now, if they changed, we're told elsewhere in the Book of Mormon, and those that changed their way of life and went back and lived with the Nephites, they become light and became light again. So it's obviously a cultural thing. It's not a racial thing, which is a permanent stamp or something like that, because after all, they all had the same genes, these people. Laman, Lemuel, Nephi, Sam had the same genes, but certain ones are recessive, certain ones will pop up at different times and so forth. And that they would be separated. And again, I will set a mark upon them that mingle with his seed with my brethren, that they may be cursed also, if you mingle them. As heard. And again, I will set a mark upon him that fighteth against thee. And the marks he was setting were the marks they were setting on themselves. And again, I say that he that departeth from thee shall no more be called thy seed. It's the naming, the identification. The name is important, you notice. The way of life is important. The clothing is significant. How they dress is significant. Everything about them, how they identify themselves, we just call this culture, the whole thing, a single package. And I will bless thee and whomever shall be called by thy seed. You see, I bless thee you're not his seed, but if you're called by his seed, it's just the same as if you were. Now we're dealing with the seed of Abraham and so forth. Henceforth and forever, these were the promises of the Lord unto Nephi and to his seed. That constant repeating of the word seed, and yet you can join in the seed and be called by that seed, by that name, forever after. Can you change your race back and forth? You don't want to, you don't need to. And it's this you change back and forth. Talk about the seed of Abraham. The Amalekites knew not, now this is it, you see, they did not know that they actually were fulfilling the prophecy and the curse. They knew not that they were fulfilling the words of God when they began to mark themselves in their foreheads. Nevertheless, they had come in open rebellion, and this curse would fall upon them. You notice it was not according to affiliation. In the same way people mark themselves today, there's a lot of that now. The SS all had tattoos on themselves, and they would mark themselves as SS. Of course, they could never be get out of it. They're scared to death. They wouldn't ask, don't ask them to take off their shirts, because they it would give them away. So, and then it makes this as a general rule. Every man that is cursed shall bring upon himself his own condemnation. You need not fear the curse of the wicked. You need not fear the evil eye. If you're to be cursed, you'll bring on yourself your own condemnation. You will put the mark on. Nobody can force you to sin. And now it came to pass, after many battles fought in the land of Zarahemla, there was another army of Lamanites in the same place. Here it goes again, you see. They got driven out there. They drove them out of the borders of their land, and there was peace for a time. All these things were done, all these wars and contentions commenced, all in just 1 year, the fifth year of the reign of the judges. Remember, 5 years ago, Alma had founded a model community. Everybody belonged to the church. Everybody was happy now. They had all sworn the covenant under King Benjamin and so forth. That's how fast they'd started to break up. Notice how many factions they'd broken up into already. And here in the fifth year, they're already engaging in these sordid wars, and here they have an echo war, a backup war following through. The name, they'd come back again, take advantage of the Nephite weakness. They drove them out of their borders. There was peace for a time, and all these things happened in 1 year, and it was just 5 years from Alma's inauguration. In 1 year were thousands and tens of thousands sent into the eternal world to receive their rewards according to their works, not according to their affiliation, not according to their flag or their uniform, but according to their works. I've known some very, very good Germans and Russians, and I was attached to Russians in Heidelberg, some of the best people you would ever know there. And some of the nastiest people you'd ever know were in our headquarters, so there you go. No, according to their works they're going to be judged. According to the spirit which they listed to obey when they were here, whether the spirit was a good one or a bad one, is given to every man to know, remember, with a perfect knowledge which is which, the individual. And every man receiveth the wages of him whom he listeth to obey, who is to obey. Nephite, Lamanite, Malachite was all the same. The party, the nation, the church itself is not evil. It's what you choose to do, how you choose to behave and so forth. You can behave very vilely in any party. You don't need to be. You can break all the Ten Commandments without being a communist. You don't have to belong to any particular faction or anything like that. Now it came to pass, and now we get in the fourth. In the sixth year and the eighth year, notice how fast things go. No glorious victory here. Now, what did I want to talk about? Oh, yes, here. Hey, there's things I just wrote down before passing it. Might be worth mentioning here. What do you have here? The royalists, Amalekites, were mixed. We saw that. And Nephites contained both the church, those in the church, and both out of the church. These two mixed armies went against each other. You can't make any distinction there, you see. Nephite or Lamanite. Nephites versus Nehors. The church versus the persecutors. Now, we find these repeated confrontations, as we mentioned the last time. It's always, what is this confrontation? Nephites versus Lamanites? No, we just saw that wasn't that at all. You can't make a clear-cut case for that. It is the kingdom as against the world, of course. And it is not, the kingdom is always running away, you know what I said, it's always getting beaten. It's always losing the battle, and this is the Rechabite principle. The righteous are always on the run in the Book of Mormon and everywhere else. Not the Christus Victor idea, onward Christian soldiers, and Christ victorious, that's having a new revival in the Christian churches. There's a new liturgical revival in which Christus Victor is becoming the big thing. We'll be the victorious ones. Well, that's not it at all. The victory is on the other side. As Paul says, here we run the race, here we get beaten. But we get rewards on the other side, not here. So the escape movement. We talked about the Fuga Mundi and so forth, and the Rechabites. John 14 and 30, the Lord says, I'm going to leave you now, for I will not walk much with you after this. He says, the prince of this world cometh who has nothing in me. And they're not going to have it any better. He says, if they've called the Lord of the house Beelzebub, what will they call the servants? He said, if they slave me, that's exactly what they'll do to you, as you have no better a chance than I have. In this world you shall have tribulation. You have good cheer, you're not going to get your reward here. And this is very clear, that these two things. Well, that's why this retreat. Why do we always retreat from the wicked into the wilderness and so forth? The church did in their last move out of Missouri, Illinois. Well, in the first place, they're hopelessly outnumbered, you see. The world, he came into the world, and the world received him not. He came to his own, and his own received him not. But so many as received him, there were a very few. One of a city, and two of a generation, or two of a tribe, as it goes, a very few. And as he says, you have tribulation here, they won't follow him. But broad is the way, and wide is the gate that leadeth to the other world. But narrow is the gate, and straight is the way, and narrow is the gate that leads to the kingdom of heaven. Few there be that find it. The multitudes will all go in the other direction, so you're hopelessly outnumbered to begin with. So it's wise to withdraw, especially if you're not allowed to resort to violence. You're not supposed to fight back here, as far as that's concerned. Curse, remember, the Book of Mormon tells us numbers of times, cursed is he who puts his trust in the arm of flesh, who makes the arm of man his confidence. You'll never win that win. Of course, they never did, even when they had great advantages and so on. It's a great story. That's what the Book of Mormon's dealing with, this whole thing. The kingdom may not resort to violence. We're not allowed to do that. Then what do you do? Well, it was planned that way. We're to be tried and tempted in this world, see. The situation is plainly stated in Alma 7 and 12 here. Alma 7 and 12, I don't need more. Where he talks about inviseth and enticeth, you know. Here you have them balanced, see, just this way. Sure enough. This is it. Where is it? Is it here? 7 and 12. Or is it 17, 7 and 12? What have I got here? It should be Alma 7 and 12. Sends his people. Where is it he invites? Oh, 7 and 9, isn't it? I thought it was 7 and 9. No, it isn't. Well, I can read.
Is it Moroni?
Moroni. What do I have here? Yes, of course it's not Alma 7 and 12. It's Moroni 7 and 12. I knew it was Moroni 7 and 12. Moroni 7 is the most instructive passage in a book in the Book of Mormon. Right. This tells us how the authority is handed on and so forth. And here it goes, you see. Where he invites us and entices. Only we don't have 12 chapters in 7, do we? Well, this is it, he tells us. That Satan is always inviting and enticing us in one direction. But at the same time, the Lord is doing exactly the same thing. He is inviting and enticing us in the opposite direction. And who decides which direction you go in? Well, you do. The enticing and inviting are equally balanced. We allow Satan, our common enemy. Does he make himself overpoweringly persuasive so that you can't possibly resist him? In that case, you haven't sinned. He's not given that. You're given the power to resist, you see. He can only deceive. All the power you give him, as the Book of Mormon tells us, is by deception. And if you believe in, if you want to follow, that's why you'll do it. That's all there is to it. If you want to go in the other direction, that's fine. It's up to you to decide. So we're being pulled equally in two directions. Which orbit will you be drawn into? The one you prefer. Now, this is psychologically sound, too. Every moment of the day, the mind must pick out and focus on one particular thing. All the rest becomes background and so forth. And who decides what the mind focuses on? You select it. You select it, and it's up to you. And the things you wish to focus on and dwell on are the things which you choose. And so, talk about this life becoming a time of probation. The choices you make every minute are, announce where your preferences are. They make clear where you stand, they make clear what you are, what your values are, and everything else. You give your way, yourself away every hour of the day. It's marvelous because it goes on right to the end, as Nephi tells us. Remember, the greatest gift God has given, he prolongs us, prolongs our life, so we'll have more chance to repent. That's the great blessing of it. And so, you have to make a choice. It's not just the two ways. The ancients used to talk about the two ways. The way of light and the way of darkness are before us at all times. You have the choice of the one or the other. And there's no middle way, you see, because they lead in opposite directions, as Heraclitus said. Odosano kato mia. The up road and the down road are one. They lead in the opposite directions. You're on the up road, depends on the way you're facing, you see, whether you're going up or whether you're going down. And to be righteous is to be facing up. You may be right at the bottom of the road in a miserable rat, or to be lost, to be wicked, is to be facing down, no matter how high you may be and how high you may have crossed. That's what Jeremiah 38 tells us about that sort of thing. So we have this choice to make all the time. And we talk about a time of probation. It is. Every motion it makes. See, you talk about body language and things like that. Everything you do and everything you say gives away what you really want and what you're really after and so forth. You give yourself away all over the place. Doesn't take a trained psychologist either. As time mounts up, see, the elements of what you've done and so forth, they all conform to a particular pattern and you become one well-marked person. And we can change it too, and that's a nice thing, knowing that you can make a choice anytime. And be frivolous. But you notice this idea of the one or the other. Can't we balance the two? No, it's an interesting thing you can't. Remember, you can't serve God and mammon, you can't have two masters and so forth. And that's the principle of the computer now. Everything bases on just a double. You can take one route or the other road, and that's it. And on that simple basis, we build an infinitely complex mesh of problem solutions and so forth, just on a simple 1-2, which is what the Egyptians did. They counted a 2, and that was their whole thing. Everything was 2s after that, you see. It's a marvelous thing. But we are faced with this one or the other business. I guess it really simplifies things for us. You get it in the Book of Mormon, but then it breaks down into divisions within divisions and so forth. You may, for example, agree with persons on a person on the subject of nuclear power, and yet be against nuclear war or something like that. You favor the nuclear industry, but you can favor part of it and not another part. You can divide yourself down. Well, he goes on here, the reversal process. Well, what we were saying here, what was so profound, is this. Yes, and why the retreat? It is not the Nephites against the Lamanites, then. The righteous Nephites willingly join with the righteous Lamanites all through the book, especially later on. They willingly join together. There's no trouble at all between righteous Nephites. They become one community. There are no more ites. Remember, it tells us after the Lord came, there were no more ites. And the Nephites join with the Lamanites when they're wicked to gain support against the Nephites. They do that all the time. Nephites and Lamanites are constant. You're getting more dangerous people in Amalekiah coming along than that. You see, the Nabulon, Amalekiah, is much more dangerous. He wants to be king both of the Lamanites and of the Nephites, and he nearly succeeds. He joins them in one. So what we have here are these two rules that are following, the two economies, really, which cannot compromise, the law of consecration, which they use, and the law of the marketplace. I see the time is up here. The Nephites must persecute the Nephites, and the Nephites must persecute, the Nephites must withdraw. Now, there's great temporary disadvantages to the law that the economy that Nephi, the law of consecration. There are great temporary disadvantages. Of course, there are eternal advantages. On the other hand, there are great temporary advantages to the law of the marketplace, but very temporary, and eternal disadvantages. You run into that. We got to learn that. We never will. Not to lay up on earth. So, because the righteous withdraw, the two kingdoms, this is another thing that surprises us. These two kingdoms we're talking about never contend in war. I say, when there's a war, it's always the bad guys against the bad guys. Nothing ever, any war. I don't think you can find another one in which that isn't the case. As the Mormon says, behold, the justice of God will overtake the wicked, and so forth. War is made by common agreement. We agree that we'll wear uniforms and have flags and so forth. We'll agree that we fight each other and so forth. It's made up by laws. We get to a marvelous thing just a little later on, where they play the Sebos game. And it's just exactly the way it used to be arranged by the ancients. It's a formal game they play, which you're allowed to kill so many and no more and so forth. why do men contrive these formal ceremonies? Notice, war is a ceremony. War is formal. Civilians wear different clothes and so forth, but war, we wear uniforms, we have bands. Bands, that's Asiatic, you see. And we have banners to identify ourselves. In the open steps of the plains, I've written a lot about this, incidentally. In the open steps of the plains, you have to identify a person at a distance, so you have to have a bright flag and a bright banner to identify his tribe or his following or something. And you have to have instruments that carry at a distance. So you have the trumpet, the Roman trumpet, but especially the Asiatic trumpet, so you have a whole brass band. That's why the military band is a band, because outdoors it makes a big noise. Well, you don't have stringed orchestras with the... No, stringed orchestras are for indoors, as you know, and they're for shepherds that don't intend their sounds to be heard a great distance. The Jews are great cultivators of string instruments, as we get from some interesting Egyptian documents. And so we have, and you have to form yourselves into brigades and so forth, because on the Asiatic steppes, they are mountain riders. They move fast, they cover vast areas, they have to be able to recognize people at a distance and so forth. So they have all these signs and all these symbols, and you have to have a uniform to spot a person immediately so you'll know who he is. Incidentally, before Normandy, 101st was to be the first division to land in Normandy, and the general was very, very much worried about bugle calls, because the Germans had certain bugle calls by which they would give signals. They would give signals by bugles. And one of my jobs was to find out what the bugle calls were and what they signified. Because you see, when your communications break down, electric and so forth, you really get down to basics every time. And they did use these bugle calls. They toodaloo-loo when you want to, either to locate themselves or tell whether to move in a certain direction and so forth. It only lasted for a week in Normandy there. But it could have been effective, but there was much too much noise to hear these bugles most of the time. But it has to be a shrill brass sound that will sound above the outcry of things, you see. And so we have... Why do we do these things? Why do we enter into this ceremonial of war? It's very ceremonial, very... Well, that's the whole thrill of it, I mean. That's the obligation. It gets everybody. It gets me. I think it's great, you see. Well, you shouldn't. It's our attempt to release ourselves from our individual covenants with God, you see. I have a covenant with God, an individual covenant, which is a very binding one. If I want to release myself from that and still feel good about it, I can say, Deus vult. God will. See, that was the banner of the Crusades. God will. And on the other hand, it was Inshallah Allah Akbar for the Arabs, on the other hand. And the Crusaders, when they clashed, each one was simply there. He was doing the will of God. But at 1095 at Clermont, where St. Bernard gave his famous speech, as recorded completely in Fulker, who was a private secretary of Baldwin. When he had the speech, and it's a marvelous one, he says, it's in the Crusades, he says, it's in the year 1095. Everything's broken down in Europe. The whole economy's broken down. Everybody's fighting everybody else. Every great noble is out to grab all the land he can from his next-door neighbor because they're considered a rule of chivalry, an obligation to. Everybody's robbing everybody else. They're sending up towers to plunder along the road. He goes on and on. There is no unity. There is no peace in Christendom. The most thing we must make a common enemy. We must make a common enemy and march against the East. The same Panhellenic oration was given against Persia by Isocrates way back 5th century BC. Same reason. We can't unite, so let's unite against somebody. Well, that's the Roman idea, you see. Inter armis, cadent leges. Our troubles cease if we can only find an outside enemy, so they had the Ager Hosticus. And so the enemy at the gates became the one slogan which could unite the Romans, the enemy at the gates. Well, this is what we have here. People forming throughout the Book of Mormon, they're forming these armies and so forth, and so that every man can, so that you can escape here, go out and have some fun,